Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Open UK's Summer of Open Source Security series. I'm the host, Matt Yankovic, and today I'm joined by Justin Cormack from Docker. Justin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Nice to be here with you.
Nice to have you here. So, Justin, you are the CTO over at Docker, and you have been at Docker for quite some time now, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been at Docker for 7 years now, actually. So it's been a interesting journey and an interesting place. It's one of the nice things about being in Docker is we're in the center of a lot of what's happening with containerization, modern software development, security. So it's been a really interesting place to be.
Yeah, so you have seen firsthand the growth of everything in the quote-unquote cloud-native space, right, and that containerization. Because when you started, I think containers were still fairly early on, and you've seen this growth over the last 5 years, really, of just massive amounts of people deploying and trusting not only containers, but that kind of cloud-native ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. When I joined, it wasn't the beginning of Docker. Docker's 10, coming up for 10 early next year, but it was still in the very much the early adopters phase, and people were still experimenting, trying to work out what it was all about. The Cloud Native Computing Foundation was founded a little bit after that. I'm on the technical oversight committee now of the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and that came out of, a set of things around. Docker started driving a standardization process in the ecosystem. There was a big kind of boom in people building projects around containers, around the cloud native, trying to work out what cloud native was actually all about and how to do it. And there was there's been a fascinating, it's been a huge explosion of new companies, new projects, new code, new security issues, everything kind of expanding over those years.
Yeah. And in fact, I find it funny, the arc of not only the container space and the cloud native space, but all technology seems to follow the same arc, which is that initial kind of like fear and doubt, and then people dismissing it. And then all of a sudden, like, it slowly permeates different applications, and then it becomes the de facto standard. And you see that. I remember back when VMs started to really replace bare metal hardware, and it was like, you can't use VMs for production. And then I remember when containers started to become popular, you can't use containers for production. And now, of course, we have these running mission critical applications all over the place. So that arc is very funny, because you hear those things over and over again for 2 or 3 years, where it's like, oh, you just can't use it for this, or you can't use it for that.
Yes.
And we continually break that mold and make the software better so it can.
Yeah, I was reading some reminiscences about the early days of VMware the other day, and that was like, we launched VMware Workstation to get people familiar with the fact that it worked as a developer, developer first move. And you kind of forget that, because VMware is so entrenched in the data center and for ops and production now, you kind of forget that they started off, well, let's make the developers comfortable with this first. And it's a really it's really interesting, because that's how all these software is adopted, but you don't really think of that with VMware, because it's come so far.
It's funny that you say that, because developers tend to lead the adoption cycle for a lot of software. But developers, and I could get in trouble for saying this, are typically focused on the things that they're most comfortable with. So things like the older tool sets, maybe the older ways of doing things. So you do have to convince them and make it easier for them to adopt that new software or try those new things.
I don't know. I think the developer population's a little like the more general population. I think that there's early adopters in the developer population, and there's the slow adopters, and it's like any kind of innovation in the population. There's lots of different people who adopt at different rates. Developer tools are fascinating, because some of them do have incredibly long lives. I mean, things like Emacs and Vi are just really, really old now, and people still, new people are still adopting and loving these tools in a way that I'm not sure I would have predicted 20 years ago when if I had been looking at those tools and thinking which ones are going to last. But I think that, you know, you see developers just really enthusiastically trying out new things as well. I mean, but you do have a backlash, you know, developers who have kind of backlash about, oh, these people are just doing this to get this on their resume, kind of resume-driven development. Like, people are trying things that are not mature in our, and, you know, there's kind of, so you get the pushback and you hear, you know, kind of ridiculous stories. I just read this really, really stupid, I think it was on Twitter yesterday, someone was saying, like, guess we, our company let people use any language to develop software, so someone deployed a bunch of software in a language they wrote. It's like, you know, kind of, that's not usually the intention of the kind of flexibility, is that you can just deploy things that only you can work on.
Okay.
And haven't. I think it's a mixed thing.
Yeah. So I think that there are people who adopt early and there are people who are pushing the envelope for that. But I think from a overall paradigm or design philosophy perspective, a lot of developers take a while to come around to new methodologies and new ways of doing things. Like the cloud native movement, when it started, yes, there were early adopters, but it took some time for it to permeate the environment and become kind of the de facto standard for developing new applications. And I think from a security perspective, something that you're exceptionally passionate about is trying to make it easier for developers to get some of those security features, some of those security things baked into that process and baked into the tool set. Maybe tell us a little bit about what you're doing from a developer perspective to help on the usability side, to make things a little easier for developers to embrace better security practices.
Yeah, and no, I think it's really interesting about that. Yeah, it does take a long time to adopt things, and developers absolutely need help. You know, they don't. Most developers don't have, you know, a lot of security training. They don't necessarily understand all the issues and risks. And also, we've had this kind of phenomenon of kind of shift left, which sometimes just seems to mean asking the developers to do more stuff and not really helping them with it. I think that I think the ideal model is that you give developers tools to do things that come with security kind of baked in, so they don't really have to think about it. And you just normalize things. I think that one of the classic examples is just how we moved from HTTP to HTTPS everywhere. Again, it took a long time, but it worked because we gave the developers, you know, really easy to use tools that fitted with their work. I think, you know, all the tools that Let's Encrypt built to help renew certificates and things like that. And I think we have to think about it like that everywhere. So, you know, what we're at Docker, we have millions of developers using our tools, so we're in a really good position to help roll these things out to the, you know, not the early adopters can, you know, kind of help themselves and use kind of quite raw prototype-y tools that they, you know, and work out how these things work for them. But the vast majority really need these things systematized. And so the things that we're looking at are things around how to make these things much easier for the average developer to use. So, for example, we're rolling things out on a kind of gradual way to get them kind of through the ecosystem. So because we've got to move from a kind of not secure by default ecosystem to a secure by default ecosystem. So for things like the Docker official images that we build that are used by millions and millions of developers to build their container images, we're starting a program of rolling out security features such as signing, software bill of materials, attestations. We're just going to roll these out gradually, provide tools for people to consume this, test out the tooling, make sure it works well at scale, work out how we kind of polyfill things where these things are missing, you know, because that the polyfill approach has worked quite well with browsers like this browser doesn't have this feature, let's fill it in. So looking at how we can kind of do that with security features and bill of materials, things like that, by providing, you know, providing versions where things, where say images don't have the right information on them, and and just, you know, working out a kind of strategic plan to go from an ecosystem where, you know, no container images or very, very few container images kind of signed and have bill of materials and attestations to one where they all do in the end, but we have to get, we have to work out how to get there, supporting the developers on that journey, providing them the right tools, making sure that they know how to use them, understand what it's for and all those things. So it's a, you know, I think these are kind of slow journeys where you have to think about, you have to think about how to get from A to B rather than just like, let's provide some tools which the early adopters use and no one else really knows how to use.
So this is an interesting question because, you know, you mentioned you all from a Docker perspective are creating tools and trying to make things easier, which is great. But you also have a lot of systems that don't have that security built in because it wasn't treated as a first-class citizen in terms of security. Maybe it wasn't thought about as much. And so it's created an environment now where we do have the problems that we have today, the, you know, whether it's the security issues and the hot topics around security. But why do you think that so many companies haven't taken more of a serious approach to security? Why do you think you put it on the back burner? Is it the push to release faster, so security just kind of gets pushed to the back? Or is it just because we're now in a time where everybody's so hyper aware, everyone will start doing it and they just didn't do it before? What do you think?
I think there's a mixture. I think the prioritization with security has always been difficult because it's hard to understand how the risks really apply to your organization. And some organizations are more or less sensitive, and some people in organizations are more or less sensitive. And you've got 20 different insurance policies you can subscribe to effectively. If you want to decide which of them you should, which of them matter, it's actually really hard. I think that's one of the problems, just prioritization. It's like people could feel that they're just spending money on things that are, you know, just not actually mitigating what something that they really see as a risk. Or I think this is always a problem just with security because there's a lot of the industry often drives a very hype driven view of you must buy this product from us because otherwise terrible things will happen. But people kind of get a bit skeptical about that kind of marketing after a while. That's very adversarial, and so I think that's one problem. I think the other problem is that a lot of time when you go into organizations, they don't know what to prioritize because they don't really understand entirely what's going on in terms of the detail of what's happening, because it's very hard to see. One of the things that we're doing around that, we recently acquired a company called Atomist, who have basically been building a software supply chain database that kind of that developers can use to understand what's going, you know, what container images they use, and the organization can you understand what container images you're using, what version of software in them, and things like that. So it's, we're really trying, and it's a tool that's designed to work across lots of different tools that you're using, lots of different registries, lots of different developer workstations, all kinds of different, you know, it link up to production, to GitHub, and so you can really try and understand across your organization what you're actually using in the way of software, what type of risks you're taking, what the unofficial processes that are going on are to some extent, rather than the official processes, because it's often very hard for organizations to really know what the developers are kind of doing at scale. That's one thing we found when we talked to them. It's just like, well, yeah, we can't see what developers are doing really, and so we don't really know where the risks are, so we don't know what to prioritize.
I don't even know if it's just a developer risk or a developer decision even. If you think about when we talk about software bill of materials and we talk about what is included, a lot of open source software and a lot of software that we're using is using other software that uses other software that uses other software that we have no idea is embedded, right? And so that kind of really detailed low level becomes a super critical problem. Let me use an example that, you know, something recently. If you are using Apache Flink, you relied on Akka and they just changed the license. So the Flink community kind of said, oh my gosh, the change in license prevents Apache from using this. Now, this isn't a security issue per se, but this does show that the dependencies of one piece of software that you might not even know you're using can impact what you're deploying and how it's used. Because in that case, if you're using Flink, you probably didn't know you were even had Akka installed. And so you didn't know that that could potentially be an issue.
Yeah, no, I think, again, that really highlights that people, you know, just don't have that broad-based understanding of what's the universe of software I'm using and what, why and how is it being imported.
And I think that's a bigger, I mean, I don't want to say it's a bigger issue, but it is more evident when you talk about whether you're using containers or you're using images or you're going to someone's, you know, AWS marketplace and spinning up instances. You choose like this piece of software or this build. You don't necessarily know what's behind the scenes. I think that also lends true to the as a service space because by design, it is behind their cloud, you know, space, and you have no idea what components are there. So there's a lot of trust that you're placing in people as well. You mentioned that you're working on some tools on the Docker space. Are those for the people creating the containers or are those using the containers? Is there the concept of some sort of like, you know, introspection into the containers and all of the different components and, you know, what has been deployed?
Yeah, so we're aiming at both audiences, but we're prioritizing the people creating. You need to know everything you're consuming and everything you're producing as an organization. But I think that the I've seen more people asking for like bill of materials for SaaS services. That started to become an ask, which is which is kind of interesting because you didn't, as you said, like. SaaS services used to be a bit of a black box and people wouldn't, you know, people would like, oh, well, give me a bill of materials for the software you're delivering, but they wouldn't ask for the bill of materials for the SaaS service. I think people are starting to ask for that. SaaS services are fascinating from the kind of like, they don't file CVEs either, which is really interesting because so there's no record of security issues in your SaaS service either, which is, really inconsistent as more and more software is being delivered as SaaS, that you don't have the same visibility into the security issues and the bill of materials. And I think people are starting to ask for more information there and the kind of pushing on that as they consume more things as SaaS. But I think overall, you know, I think that both producers and consumers really want to know more about, you know, more about what's in the stuff that they're consuming and why, where it's come from, how it's there, what, you know, licenses and responsibilities and those kinds of things. So it's, I think there's definitely going to be a lot more transparency around that and a lot more, you know, a lot more tooling and a lot more asks on people to actually produce that information.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that as we go through that, we'll develop standards around that as well and how we want to see that. It will take a little while. Like we said, it does take a while sometimes for things to catch on. But I think it's going to be critical to have transparency across all the organizations and all the different components that you're using. Justin, you've been in this security space for a while, and I know you've kept up on trends. What kind of issues do you see people make on a regular basis, like from a security perspective? What are those common things that if you could tell people to just stop doing, avoid these situations? Are there a couple that pop to the top of your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the things, a lot of the security issues are still, are the very well-known ones. I mean, if you look at things like the OWASP list, it doesn't change very fast. I think there are some things that we're seeing more of because people, I mean, with cloud native, people haven't got used to managing credentials effectively, and you see a lot of credential leak attacks because people have a lot of credentials that, unfortunately, a lot of them are kind of long-lived rather than ephemeral credentials, and they, you know, the mechanisms for getting credentials to systems and to allow them to do things, getting better, but the early pattern was like, we'll issue long-lived credentials and we'll give them to services and it kind of, it'll work. But unfortunately, they're prone to leaks and attacks on where those credentials are. You know, I think things like the CodeCov attack last year, which itself was caused initially by a credential leak, and then it was an attack that leaked more credentials that then potentially could have been used elsewhere, and so on. So that's an attack surface that I think there is there's been some gradual improvements. People are working at how to have ephemeral tokens much more effectively now. So that's good. There are somewhat better cross-service credential things like the JWT support for, say, GitHub Actions to talk to something like AWS rather than having to have permanent AWS credentials in your GitHub Actions. You can just use the certificates that are generating things like that. So there's some, you know, signs of improvement, but there's been a lot of credential leaks, I think. And just, you know, even the Uber thing the other day, they had their AWS passwords in a shared drive. It's like, that shouldn't happen.
Well, but is this more of a, do you think that this is more of a human thing that we just aren't following best practices, or is it because the tooling doesn't exist? Because my opinion is the tooling exists. It might not be great for developers to use on a regular basis. The methods, it's more, you know, the human error side of things in a lot of these, in my opinion.
I think that the tooling's still very new for a lot of these things. The GitHub JWT stuff only came out last year. It takes people a while to roll it out. It involves integrations into other systems to make it work. You know, so there's definitely a kind of convenience thing. There's better tooling to detect things like human error type or human, oh, I didn't realize you shouldn't do that, things like checking credentials into Git, which people tend to do.
And that's fairly new though, right? Because we used to have a lot of credentials put into Git by accident.
Is it an accident or, I mean, it's,
oh, that's true. It could be on purpose.
But it was kind of on purpose. So, you know, it's like, oh, it'd be more convenient if the credentials are in Git, but it's like, the tooling for checking those things is new and is not as widespread as it should be, and you know, I would highly recommend that everyone has some tooling to stop them committing credentials into Git.
Please don't do that. Git is not for passwords.
But yeah, so I think it's a mixture of education, tooling, kind of tooling to influence policy. You know, it's kind of a mixture of things there.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I have been talking about for the last couple of years, because I've seen so much of it firsthand, is a lot of people are using software that they're not intimately familiar with. They don't necessarily understand it, whether it's newer software or older, especially as we start to build more as a service type offerings. We put a lot of trust in the vendors that we're choosing and using and the software that we're using to do things like have sane defaults out of the box, to have the ability to keep things at least minimally secure out of the box. And I think a lot of that trust is sometimes misplaced. And I'm not saying that the vendors or, you know, maintainers of projects are doing things wrong. It's just that they're building software and they're making it accessible to a wider audience. And people just assume their use case, their usage is perfect for it. And they just assume that everything's taken care of, you know, whether it's default passwords, which is insanely easy to change, or configuration options that don't set up the bare minimum encryption or SSL type settings. Those are more common than not still. But I think that the current generation of folks are so busy, focused on developing new features, new applications, they're putting a lot of trust in the infrastructure choices that they've made to just handle a lot of the things that sometimes they don't know about, and sometimes things that they in the back of their mind know about, but they're busy focused on new development.
Yeah, I mean, it's that area is really interesting, and I think that there's a bunch of issues. One of the things that we found, because we've had this issue about non-secure defaults with some of the CNCF projects, and one of the things is that the project will open source projects are often really configurable. Open source people like configurability because it's like, well, I don't know how you're going to use my project, so I'll give you lots of options. But that makes it very difficult to actually have default security. It's like, if I give you a choice of, like, there's a choice of 15 ways to plug in how users are, or, you know, how users are managed in the system. Well, how can I have a default user? Because I don't know how you want to manage users. You might want to connect this to your single sign-on. You might want to have, you know, connected to some other user accounts or whatever. I don't know how you want to use the project. So I can't set up default security, the project says, because I don't know how you want to use it. And I've given you a lot of documentation that tells you how to plug all this in. It's your problem. And then, of course, people set it up and it's got a, you know, there's no security or something, you know, because the default is it's just open, or it's just got a default password, yeah, or something, because you're not supposed to use it like that. But that's, you know, if you just run it, that's what happens. And so it's really, there's this weird trade-off between flexible configuration and secure defaults. Like if I told you how to configure this and I said, you have to connect it to, say, single sign-on, then it would be secure. But if I want to be more flexible and let you have choices, then it's really difficult for me to have defaults. But you know, we've seen again and again that this doesn't work. People will set something up by just running, you know, they'll run the container image, they won't read the documentation, they'll start it and connect it to the outside world. And possibly even disable some of the security features if they can, because it's more convenient. And that's, you know, that's been really bad. I think it was fascinating that the California decided that they would enforce unique passwords for physical devices, and that's actually been quite effective. And actually, it's rare to buy a physical device without a one-time password now, which is great. You know, I think that we don't know how to do that with software things in the same way as we do with hardware yet.
And I think from a developer perspective, like I said, you know, there is that ease. And you mentioned turning off things. I mean, I think we've all been guilty about that in our past. Maybe we're more enlightened now. But I can I remember 25 years, God, it's ages ago. I ran a small website that had a game on it that we built, and it was hacked because I just threw stuff up. I was building it. This was in college. And as I was building that, I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to go to something more secure. And then, so I found OpenBSD, which I don't know if you remember OpenBSD.
Yeah, I know OpenBSD way well, back, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Way back then, OpenBSD was everything's locked by default. And I started to try and use it. And I was like, oh my God, like I can't like get all the stuff that I needed. So then I went back to something else. And I think that that mentality from a developer perspective totally still permeates a lot of people's development processes, right? So if I can't get this running in, an hour or two, I'm going to look for...
Yeah. My favorite is SE Linux, where if you Google SE Linux, it would also complete how to turn it off, because people would...
yes.
You know, Red Hat would be trying to install SE Linux, which is great, but people then couldn't do something, and then they would say SE Linux blocked you doing that, and they would Google, how do I turn SE Linux off, because I want to do that, like, because they couldn't work out how to fix the actual issue, and the easiest way was just turn it off.
For years, the recommended best practice to run MySQL was to turn off SE Linux.
Yeah.
I think you're just not going to get it to work.
Yeah.
That's silly, right? So,
yes.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that,
it was just, you know, it was difficult to fix the issues he found. You know, it was something that it worked for things out of the box if you used them how the person expected you to use them. But if you were installed something not out of the box or that you wanted to use differently, then it was suddenly a problem. And it was very hard to find out what the fix was.
Yeah. So Justin, let me ask you this final question here. What's your advice for those who are listening from a security standpoint? Is there a couple of things that you would tell them to be cognizant of or watch out for, or things that maybe are coming on the horizon that they should get excited or amped up about?
I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot going on. I think that, you know, there's a lot of work to do if you're interested in security. I mean, one of the things I'd recommend is, like, if you find security interesting, it's a great field to move into from somewhere else. So because there's so much more still to do, and it's such a critical area, and there's people coming into the field with an understanding of how the rest of the world works in practice is incredibly valuable. And I think there's a lot of really exciting things on automating policy and managing organization and policy at scale. But again, they need data and understanding of where the organization is now and what's really going on to make them effective. But I think, you know, there's great tools like Open Policy Agent, but that, you know, in the CNCF and other tools, but like there's a huge amount to do in the kind of automated policy space, and it's really early still. And there's lots of exciting work going on there in terms of like how do you enforce that things should happen in software processes, and understand how to manage making processes to do what you want in your organization, and understanding whether that's happened and how you manage exceptions and how you monitor that. I think there's a lot of work to do to make that really realistic for organizations to scale, but I think it's a really, you know, it's a kind of applying software to an exciting new area, for example. That's one of the things I'm really interested in.
Oh, very cool. Well, Justin, thank you for coming and hanging out with me today, chatting a little bit about security. It was really interesting to learn about, you know, things going on in the Docker space, your thoughts on security. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks very much. Been good to chat.